Mm, okay. The subject of this talk and also the talk today is going to be the Kakeya conjecture. And I decided to split this up into two parts. Today, I'm going to talk about Kakeya sets, how you construct them, what you do with them, and so on. And tomorrow, I'm going to talk about applications of all of this to analysis. Okay, so let me start by explaining what a Kakeya set is. We're going to have to go back to 1917. That's when a Japanese mathematician, Kakeya, asked the following question. Let's say that you have a line segment of length 1, and he called it a needle. So here's one. And I want to rotate it by 360 degrees. I'm going to say that this is one. And I want to turn it around, keeping it in a plane. And I want to use as little area in the plane as possible. So, for instance, if I just do the most obvious thing, it uses a full disk of radius 1/2, so you can calculate what the area of that is. The question that Kakeya originally asked was to find the smallest convex set within which you can do that. Now, it's not very difficult to see that you can also use a triangle of an equilateral triangle whose height is 1. You sort of start like this. You can turn around the needle like so. Then you move it to the next vertex, then you turn it around some more, and so on. And this is indeed the smallest convex set that you can use for that purpose. That was proved by Pal in, I think, 1921. So we still have to figure out what's the smallest non-convex set. There was a conjecture for some time that the smallest non-convex set looks sort of like this. It's a somewhat more sophisticated three-way turn. So that remained open for a couple of years. Eventually, it was solved in a somewhat surprising way. To see how that happened, we're going to have to move from Japan to Russia. Sometime around 1920, Besikovich was working on a problem in analysis. I'm going to tell you tomorrow about what that problem was and how it was related to this. And anyway, what he needed to construct is a set in the plane, preferably compact, which contains a unit line segment in each direction. Thank you. And he did, in fact, construct such a set. I'm going to show you more or less what the construction looks like. The original construction by Besikovich was a little bit more complicated.
We wanted Samson Girls and Hanging
Oops. I'm sorry. This was supposed to be a set of measure zero. I think I said that, but I didn't write it down. And anyway, that's the whole point here. Thanks. The original construction was a little bit more complicated, so I'm going to show you a variation on it with some simplifications due to Perron and Schoenberg. But there were also many other variations on that construction, some similar to that, some looking really, really different. Anyway, here's how you construct such sets. First of all, it's going to be enough to say construct a set which contains all line segments with slopes between this and that. I can have everything in this angle. So I just need to use these line segments. Because then if I have that, then I can cover a whole unit disk by four regions identical to this. I just need to rotate that four times, put it together. So I just need to look at slopes between this and that. So here's what you do. You start with a triangle. Excuse me?
Is there a right angle? Or?
It doesn't actually matter. I mean, I could divide it in four parts or you know, 16. If it doesn't make a difference. And anyway, I want to start with a triangle like this. I'm going to divide it in four parts. And then I'm going to shift these four triangles around so they intersect a lot. So let's start with these two. I'm going to leave the first one alone. And then I'm going to shift the second one so they overlap in this kind of way. Now, these two have, this whole region has smaller area than that. You can compute exactly what it's going to be, depending on how much you shift them and so on. You do the same thing for these two triangles. And then you observe the following. Now you have two triangles coming up here. There's one and there's the other. This here is kind of small, so I'm going to disregard it for the time being. And now I want to get these two triangles to overlap. So I'm going to move those two according to the same principle. Looks sort of like this. And then I have to keep in mind that I have these little tips here. So altogether I get something that looks sort of like this. Now if I use just four triangles, it's going to get smaller, but not that much smaller. So I'm going to have to take a very large number of triangles and then iterate the construction a large number of times. And then I'm going to have to take the limit as the number of these cuts goes to infinity. uh, So that construction was apparently published in Russia in 1920. Now, given everything else that was going on in Russia at that time, it's kind of surprising that anybody could be bothered to write mathematical papers, but anyway. A few years later, Dusikovich left Russia, and only then he found out about this question. And then he figured out that actually this could be modified to answer that. Namely, the answer here is that the area can be, it cannot be zero, but it can be as small as you like. And here's how you do it. You construct one of those, a close enough approximation of a Dusikovich set. So now if I start playing with my needle again, as long as I stay within a triangle, one of those small things, I can just rotate it any way I like. So the problem is when I have to move from like one triangle to the other. But there's also a way to go around that. This is called pulse joints. Let's say that I have a triangle here and a triangle there, and I want to go from this one to that. Sorry? Yes, they have one parallel side. So let's say that they look like this, and these two sides are parallel. And somehow I have to move from here to there. So I'm not going to, when I'm still in the top triangle, I'm not going to quite go all the way here. I'm going to stop somewhere very close to the top edge, to the top edge, like here. And then I'm going to take that needle, walk over to the other side of the classroom, rotate it just a tiniest little bit, go back, and I'm going to end up there. And I can do that using as little area as I want to. Okay, so that combined with this solved this problem. There are some other variations on that, like for instance, can you make such a set simply connected, or maybe you could do it without walking to the other side of the classroom and so on. It turns out that you can actually do that too if you work hard enough. There's, for instance, a construction due to Cunningham. I think it was 1971. He constructed a Kakeya set in the plane so that it's also simply connected. And fits inside a unit disk. And also can have arbitrarily small measure. Now, once you have the two-dimensional construction, if you ask a similar question in n dimensions, can you do it in R3? You take a line segment in each direction. Now you have a lot more line segments. And can you have a set of three-dimensional measure 0, which contains translates of all of them? That can be done using the same construction by just taking a product with say, a unit disk. Okay, so we know that we can construct Kakeya sets of measure 0. The next question is, can you construct Kakeya sets which also have in Rn which have a dimension less than n. This is a question that turns out to be relevant to various problems in analysis. Now, this is supposed to be an expository talk, so maybe I should explain what I mean by dimension. If you know what Hausdorff dimension is, then you can think of that. In this talk, I'm going to use something called the Minkowski dimension. For technical reasons, it's a little bit easier to explain some arguments when you use that. The way you define Minkowski dimension is as follows. Suppose that you have a set in Rn. So, okay, there's a set. I'm going to look at a small neighborhood of it. I'm going to fix some small number delta. And E delta is going to denote the delta neighborhood of E. So I'm going to take a small neighborhood of that. And then I'm going to look at how this depends on delta. Have the asymptotics of the form the volume of E delta is about constant times delta to some power alpha, then the Minkowski dimension of E is defined as n minus alpha. This is in Rn. So, for instance, if you look at a line segment in the plane, if you take a small neighborhood of it, this is going to be a thin rectangle, and the area of that is about delta. Now we're in R2, right? So here if alpha is 1 and 2 minus 1 is 1, so the dimension of a line segment is 1. For a square in R2, if I take a delta neighborhood of that, I have, again, basically a square with a little bit of stuff around it. And so I know that E delta is always at least 1. That means that the alpha has to be 0. And so that means that the dimension is 2 minus 0, and that's 2. Not very surprising again. An example of a set with fractional Minkowski dimension is the Cantor set. That's the usual two-thirds Cantor set. I take the line segment, say, from 0 to 1, delete the middle part, then I delete the middle part of each of the segments I have left, and so on. And that has a dimension. Logarithm of 2 over logarithm of 3. Now, of course, we know that the control set has measure 0. Anything in Rn that has dimension less than n has to have n-dimensional measure 0. So this is the question that we're going to be asking about Kakaya sets. We know that they can have measure 0. Can we also make them have dimension less than n? The first result that I'd like to mention is that maybe I should first state the conjecture. The conjecture is that the dimension of Kakaya sets in Rn.
Did you define the Kakaya set in Rn?
I think I did.
Okay.
In Rn, I might as well do it twice. So these are sets in Rn and contain a line segment in each direction. The conjecture is that any such set has dimension n.
No.
Once I have a rotating needle and anything continuous, then the measure of that can be arbitrarily small, but it cannot be 0. And that automatically means that the dimension has to be n. So here I have to work with line segments as opposed to swinging needles. Okay. But by dimension, you can understand Hausdorff or Minkowski. There's also another variation on that I'm going to discuss next time. So first of all, this is known in dimension 2. This was first proved by Davies. I think it was 71. And then there was another argument given by Cordoba about 1976, something like that. Cordoba's argument is a little bit more useful for applications in analysis. The statement is that the sets have to have dimension 2. And I'm going to show you a quick sketch of how you prove something like this. I have this set that contains lots of line segments. Now, for each line segment, I need to look at the volume of the delta neighborhood of the set. Namely, I want to prove that this is bounded by a constant times delta to the epsilon for any epsilon positive. the constant could depend on the epsilon. So that's what I want to prove. Now, for each line segment here, I'm going to take a delta neighborhood of that. So that's going to be basically a rectangle of length 1 and width about delta. No, they don't. In fact, if you look at the example I showed you earlier, they didn't. And actually, if they do intersect at all points, if all of them intersect at one point, then you get a disk. It's, so that doesn't quite have measure zero. But actually, this is something I'm going to come back to in a second. So I don't really want them to intersect all at one point. But I think I do want them to intersect quite a lot. Because if they all disjoint, then the volume of the set is going to be the union of... So the area of the set is going to be the union of the areas of these, and that's about 1. Anyway, so the two-dimensional argument is based on estimating the size of intersections of such rectangles. Let's just take 2 of them. And let's say that the angle between the 2 line segments is about theta. Then the area of the intersection this is just very simple geometry. This is going to be bounded by let's see, delta squared over theta times the constant. Because the whole thing is contained in a triangle like this. One side of it is, let's see, I guess you could split it up like so and look at the area of these 2 triangles. It's probably the simplest way to see it. Anyway, so you estimate the area of each intersection like that, and then you figure out how many tubes you have and how many can intersect at any given angle. So for instance, if the angle is small, then the intersection is going to be large, they can almost overlap. But on the other hand, you don't have a lot of tubes that intersect at this small angle. So that then you just count those intersections and you essentially get this. Actually, you get that with a logarithm of 1 over delta here.
So any bit, is there intersection?
No, for any... The other way around. For any any epsilon, there exists a constant such that this is true for all delta.
All delta, especially small. Why don't you write down the logarithm, then
there won't be any logarithm. Okay, fine. Constant logarithm of 1 over delta.
Minus 1.
And actually, I think you can take square root of it.
Minus 1.
Oops. Sorry. I think that there were people looking at exactly how many powers of that logarithm you really need, that sort of stuff. Anyway, so it's known in dimension 2. So now let's look at what happens in higher dimensions. The problem is still open in all dimensions higher than 2. And I'm just going to explain some of the arguments that have been used in this context. So the first argument that I'd like to explain is the Bush argument due to Burgin. The idea is the following. Now we go back to this idea of having a lot of tubes intersecting at a given point. Actually, I'll show you the calculation here. So you should maybe see it at least once. Let's say that E is a Kakaya set. And this is an Rn. I want to estimate the volume of the delta neighborhood of it from below. Now, this set, the delta neighborhood, contains a tube of width about delta in each direction. So in particular, I can choose about delta to the minus n minus 1 cubes that are separated by angle at least delta. This is also about delta. Now, suppose that the volume of E delta is bounded by constant times delta to some power alpha. I want to figure out some bound on alpha. Now, if I just take all of those tubes, each one has volume about delta to the n minus 1. That's 1 in one direction plus delta in each of the other directions, so it's that. If I just multiply the number of tubes by the volume of each one, then I get 1. So if I want to go down to that, I need to get them to intersect a lot. So in particular, I must have point X, which belongs to about delta to the minus alpha tubes. That's just because by counting multiplicity. Okay, so I have a point that contains a lot of them. It's something sort of like that. And now, notice that they all point in different directions, right? So as long as I stay away from that point, that they all are going to be disjoint. So maybe I don't want to look at the middle part of it, but if I take the rest of this whole object, that's what's called the bush, then I can just add the volumes of these tubes and get the volume of the whole thing. Okay, so I get something looking sort of like this. And that has volume. At least constant times the number of tubes times the volume of each one. On the other hand, this is contained in the set E delta, so E delta is going to be at least that. Now I'm going to compare the two inequalities. I get that constant times delta to the minus alpha plus n minus 1 is less or equal to some other constant times delta to the power alpha. And that gives me an inequality between the exponents. And so I get that minus alpha plus n minus 1 has to be greater or equal to alpha. And if I solve it for alpha, I get that alpha is less or equal n minus 1 over 2. And that means that the dimension of the set is at least n minus alpha, and that's n plus 1 over 2. This argument, by the way, works for the Minkowski dimension. But also it can be adapted to the Hauser dimension setting if you take the tubes that are not quite filled. You take a similar setup, but each tube is almost hollow. There's only a small part of it that's actually filled up. The next argument is usually called the hairbrush argument. This is due to Wolf, 1994. A hairbrush looks like this. You take a tube if you go over this part of the argument, you'll see that you don't just have one point that belongs to a lot of tubes. You actually have to have a lot of such points. So you fix a base tube which contains a lot of points of high multiplicity. And then you take all the tubes that intersect that. You get this sort of object. And then what you do with that is you split it into planes that go through the center tube. And then everything that lies in each of those planes is basically a two-dimensional Kakaya set. So you apply the two-dimensional result that I mentioned earlier. So then essentially you go through the same argument, except that here instead of just one bush that we had before, we have a bigger object like this. And that improves the exponent here by 1. So what you end up getting is that the dimension of the set is at least n plus 2 over 2. Okay, so that was the best result available for some time. And the next result that improved on that in high dimensions went in a somewhat different direction. This was again due to Burgin in 2000. He used something called additive number theory. Now, what's funny about it anyway?
No, it's just the phraseology. No,
okay, so I'm going to try to explain the idea behind that. Let's forget that you've ever seen this. Right? That doesn't exist. And I'm going to try to improve on this argument. Like I said before, you actually, if you want to have an estimate of this form on the size of E, you need to have a lot of points of high multiplicity. In fact, you can prove something stronger, because if any point here had multiplicity higher than this, then I would actually get a better estimate for this part, and that would improve my exponent. So I cannot really have anything bigger than this in anywhere. So assuming that this is an optimal estimate. On the other hand, if I have too many points of low multiplicity, then the tubes just don't intersect that much, and I can improve the estimate anyway. So roughly what I get is that just about every point has about this multiplicity. Now let's forget that we know the word almost, and let's say that every point in E delta belongs to as many tubes as you get from this calculation. And that's going to be delta to the minus n minus 1 over 2. Now, I'm going to take my Kakeya set and take three horizontal planes at equal distances from each other. And then I'm going to look at the intersections of these tubes with the planes in question. Let's say that the distance here is 1/2. Here it's 1/2 also. There's some set in which
they
hyperplanes. So these are n minus 1 dimensional. There's some set here that you get as the intersection of E with the plane. Let's call it A. There's some other set I get in the second plane. Let's call it B. And another one I get here that's C. Now, each point belongs to this number of tubes, and the total number of tubes is delta to the minus n minus 1. So now if I have to have this many tubes through each point here, I can divide this by that. I get that the cardinality of A is about delta to the minus n minus 1 over 2. And same for B and C. But that's just by counting these. But then again, all of them, all of the cubes from, say, this point have to go to different points in B and different points in C. So essentially, for any two points, say, in A and B, I need to have a tube through those two points. Except that there's a small problem with that. If I take, let's focus on these two. This is one, this is the other. They intersect in somewhere in the plane here in the middle. Now, because these distances are equal, this is going to be the midpoint of each of those line segments. Right? So now there's a simple geometrical fact that if two line segments intersect at midpoints, then these two are going to have to be parallel. And that's going to be a bit of a problem because they all were supposed to point in different directions. Now, how do I know that I actually have these two tubes in this set? Well, I don't. I sort of do in the heuristic argument. The rigorous argument has to be a little bit different. Sorry? Well, I don't really know that. That's what I was going to explain next. You sort of assume this in the heuristic argument, that this sort of the idea of what you're trying to do. But actually, if you want to do it rigorously, you have to do something a little bit different. You have those two sets A and C. And then you define, let's call it G, the set of all pairs AC in these two sets, such that there's a tube from A to C. And then, let's see. A denotes this coordinate. C, this one. And these are just going to stand for the coordinates in these two horizontal planes. So it's like n minus one dimensional coordinates. Now, the midpoint is A plus C over 2. And I have an estimate on the cardinality of this set. The set of all sums with A and C in G is about the same as the cardinality of these two sets. Let's call this N. And then this is also going to be N. And then we want to use that to estimate the cardinality of the set of differences A minus C. The reason I want to look at differences is that the difference tells you what the slope of the line is. with it's not exactly trivial to do that. The original estimate due to Bourguin was basically, I want to prove that this is bounded by n to the 2 minus epsilon. 2 would be the trivial estimate. If A and C have cardinality n, then the total number of pairs is n squared, so obviously the number of all possible differences is bounded by n squared. Well, what I want to get is an improved estimate with some better power of n. And that's going to give me an improvement on the previous Kakeya argument. So we're going to prove this for epsilon equal 1/13, and then this was improved by Katz and Tao to 1/6. And there are also further improvements using more planes here instead of just 2. Okay, and one more thing that I want to mention is how you combine this with the hairbrush argument to get an improved estimate in dimension 3. This was a joint paper with Katz and Tao. In R3, the dimension of E is at least n plus 2 over 2 plus some small epsilon. And unlike all the previous estimates... Sorry?
You're in the sleep.
Yeah. Anyway, we got this improvement for some value of epsilon that we don't actually compute. And unlike all the results I talked about so far, this one works only for the Minkowski dimension, and moreover, you have to take the upper Minkowski dimension. That's a further technical problem. This we cannot get this for Hausdorff dimension.
Now, hang on a minute. These estimates with given epsilon after n give you something bigger than n over 2, right? It's not just that you improve the number.
No. What this gives you is let's see. I think the original Bourguin's result was 13n plus 12 over 25 or something like that. Is that correct? Yeah.
So
essentially the coefficient of n is bigger than 1/2. And that improves on this in large dimensions. In dimension 3, this was still the best estimate until dimension 3 is, I guess, kind of interesting for us because that's the dimension in which we live, most of us anyway. And anyway, so we tried to combine this approach with the hairbrush argument to improve on that. And that turned out to be very hard. Now, first thing you can do is you can take that and then look at each bristle of that. And when you look at it closely, it actually has a hairbrush of its own. And then all of them have to basically coincide. You can iterate it as many times as you like, and you don't get anything bigger than this. You somehow don't really believe that's possible. That this is possible, but somehow it's really difficult to contradict it using just geometrical arguments. So you play with those hairbrushes, and you find that they cannot overlap unless everything is very regular, very self-similar. There are really nice patterns coming up. I lived in Princeton when I worked on it, and there's not that much you can do in terms of entertainment when you live in Princeton, so in my free time I was working on that. This is roughly what the set has to look like. Each point has a plane where in which all of the tubes through it have to lie. So, depending on how you look at it, if you look at it from a decent angle, you actually see a lot of holes in it. So that's this structure that I just mentioned. And then eventually you get enough structure that you can basically factor out one dimension, and then you can use essentially this type of arguments. So basically you prove that this whole thing has to be so regular and so similar and so on that there's no way you can do it without some of the lines being parallel. Okay, so maybe I should finish by telling you what's the current state of affairs. So for Hausdorff dimension, we get n plus 2 over 2 for n equal 3 and 4. That's still best, as far as I know.
You say it is estimate every time from below. Yeah.
From below.
In no one dimension you know that it may be slightly less than n.
Sorry?
In no one dimension you know that it may...
No, it's still open. Anyway, that's still the best result in dimensions 3 and 4. In higher dimensions, that was due to Wolf. In higher dimensions, it's 2 minus square root of 2 times n minus 4 plus 3. This is due to Katz and Tau. That's using the sort of arithmetic arguments. For the Minkowski dimension, it's at least n plus 2 over 2 plus some epsilon, again in dimensions 3 and 4. And...
what is epsilon? One over 6?
No, that's... wish it was. Yeah. I really would have liked that. It's something more like 10 to the minus 10.
Exists.
Exists. And it's positive. It is. And in higher dimensions, it's the same as here, 2 minus square root of 2, n minus 4 plus 3. That's for n between 4 and 24, and n plus... this is getting ridiculous, but anyway... T is about 1.6753.
Oh.
So that's the... Sorry?
So for large n,
it's... But it's still not that close to n.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an improvement over previous results. Yeah. Yeah. So that's the best that's.
My split is fair. I don't know. It is more than half or less.
You missed 10% of the dimension.
1.6.
Okay.
Okay. So maybe I should stop here.
Okay. Questions? Comments? Okay. So looking forward to next time.